So a good rear naked choke places your elbow at the center of my windpipe and then squeezes here
to then create a compression
that does that. Welcome back to Human Reaction, where we are deconstructing the hypno-narratives. My name is David Rand. We got Joe Sheehan here and Bennett on the buttons. Please like, follow, subscribe, do all the social media things. If you're in YouTube, hit that notification bell. That notification bell is a big difference in when you're going to see our episodes. We got 1,300 subscribers and about 100 people maybe see our episodes when they drop. And now we're at a couple episodes per week. You're going to want to see them. Make sure to hit that little notification bell. And if you want to get into involved in our community across both YouTube and Spotify and all the other places you can find us, check out our Discord. We got a lot of great discussion going on in there. We have our meme of the show.
Used to be meme of the week. Now we do two shows a week, so yeah, it's meme of the show.
We're switching to meme of the show. And what we have here is one of those classic meme formats, the four quadrant breakdown. We got the healthcare CEO gunned down in a premeditated murder. The leftists saying, lol, good riddance, as classic. And then you have the guy who Kyle Rittenhouse shot, serial child molester, killed in self-defense by a teenager he was chasing. And the left was, of course, freaking out.
Bleeding from the eyes. Yes. Classic.
Yeah. So what are we talking about today, Joe?
Well, today we have a couple of very interesting stories. I did say stories, but that wasn't the one.
You did not specify.
Both coming out of New York City, very interestingly. But I'll cue this one up with a special intro for you. In the socialist criminal justice system, healthcare CEOs are considered especially heinous. In New York City, the dedicated assassins who murder these vicious felons are members of an elite squad known as the Special Justice Unit. These are their stories. That was the
one. That's pretty good. That was good.
Thank you. If you are a small business owner looking for exponential growth, you have to connect with Adam Thune at Intellectual Patriots. He will revolutionize your business game and help you get to the next level. Adam can streamline your business practices and advertising strategies to improve your bottom line. His expertise in data engineering means he can build you the systems you need to collect and analyze market data. His mission is to provide you with invaluable insights to fuel your success. From grant writing and business proposals to digital systems integrations, even AI management, Intellectual Patriots is a one-stop shop for cutting-edge solutions. Don't wait another second. Visit intelpatriots.com to learn more. That's intelpatriots.com. This episode is brought to you by Revved Up Promo, the official apparel partner of Human Reaction. Revved Up is a premier full-service shop specializing in laser engraving, screen printing, and embroidery. Not only are they now making all of our apparel right down the road from us, they can do the same for your brand and ship it to you anywhere in the world. Revved Up helps you navigate the extensive universe of merch options and uses state-of-the-art techniques to showcase your brand in its very best light. So if you want to support our show and our generous sponsor, you can now do so by buying our merch and by turning to Revved Up Promo for your own custom apparel needs. Reach them at revveduppromo.com. That's with two V's and two P's, or just check the show notes for a link. All right, so clearly we're talking about Luigi Mangione.
Luigi, yeah.
Yes. And of course, the way that it intertwines with the Daniel Penny verdict, he was not guilty for killing the person who was threatening people on the train, Jordan Neely. So we'll be getting into both of those stories. David, why don't you cue us up here?
Yeah, so originally the kind of the plan was I was going to dive into each of these cases and get into the cases themselves. And then I watched this podcast with Brianna Joy Gray and Glenn Greenwald. Now, I want to say up front, I like both these people. They're both, I think, overall good leftists, the best kind of leftists, the one that are willing to call out free speech infractions from their own side, who are good on foreign policy for the most part. And I mean, especially Glenn Greenwald is like a hero of mine. So I'm driving to jiu-jitsu this morning. I throw it on there for my, you know, my morning, my commute in, and oh my God, dude.
And he strangled the guy to death.
And then he was reeing like the leftists in this meme. Blood squirting out of his
eyes. Losing it. And so I want to dig into it because I think it teases out a lot of the background, the underpinnings of our social philosophy, at least of how leftists are. And we've spent a lot of time talking about the right and all the problems on the right and all of our quibbles and disagreements. And I want to get into this week, I think this exposes a lot of the underlying disagreements that we have with the left and uses, of course, some of the best people on the left for it. So we'll get it started with this part of the podcast. Is there are ambitions here in the theme of this particular podcast, which is on the Bad Faith podcast. Go check it out with Brianna Joy. This is after she left the Rising, fired for being too good on Israel-Palestine, right? So high integrity woman. I really appreciate that about her. But she had Glenn Greenwald on to do the same thing, to compare these two cases together and kind of do the power analysis. So we'll...
Is the name of the show a little bit ironic given today's topic?
We'll see.
All right.
You get going.
So this is the thing that really drives me insane. So the condemnation of the left, where I think most of the sentiment emerged from, that what this killer did was at least understandable, if not commendable. The whole basis of the condemnation, how dare you celebrate this person's death or express some degree of happiness, anything other than disgust and rage that the fact that he was murdered, is based on this principle that they're claiming that it's always wrong to celebrate the death of a human being unless there's justice and due process administered, like a death penalty after a trial, or I guess maybe in like some war where the laws of war, but in general, it's wrong to celebrate someone's death. For every single person claiming this, I can name in 10 seconds, 100 people whose deaths they would celebrate. You think, for example, if tomorrow Nicolas Maduro died, or Bashar al-Assad died, or Vladimir Putin died, or the Iranian mullahs died, or, you know, whomever, Laura Ingraham and her guests would not be instantly saying how great this was, how, you know, if anybody was expressing sadness over it, they would instantly condemn those people for expressing sadness at the death. We all have people who maybe we don't want to go ourselves and kill, or maybe we do want to, but just can't get ourselves to, but whose deaths we sort of say, this was well-deserved. Maybe the world is better off without them. It's just such hypocrisy. And
yeah. So to start it off, I want to talk about the soft bigotry of low expectations, right? How escalatory spirals work is you are a hypocrite on something and you set a standard and then you violate it. And so I say, that gives me permission now to violate my principles and be a hypocrite too. And then we're on this road of degrading spirals of hypocrisy, right? Where we can say, well, you celebrated stuff that I don't like, and I celebrate, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
Rather than saying, actually, human life is precious, and you have a point there, and I should back off my rhetoric about that, and I should think carefully about how I talk about the death of somebody.
Totally, yeah.
You know? And you know the meme that we put up front? I'm not talking about jokes. Jokes are different than that, because jokes are, by definition, not something you really mean, right? So, for example... if someone aggresses against somebody...
So Puerto Rico is not an island of trash.
They do have a trash problem on Puerto Rico, though. I just say that. Most island countries have trash problems. Anyways, and we're not getting into that right now, Bennett. Can't distract me today, sir. Okay, so the soft bigotry there is to lower our standards for the preciousness of human life in all cases. Now, a great example of this, and this is what always sticks out to me because of my age, you know, millennial and all that kind of stuff, is when they got Osama bin Laden. What I remember is the celebrations. And I remember, even as a guy who was, you know, very conservative and throughout most of the early parts of the terror war were very supportive, and 9/11 affected me deeply, and I read the Quran afterwards, and I got really into philosophy and religion and stuff like that in order to understand what was going on. Despite all the parts of my personality that were orientated towards this, what I saw as a threat to me and my way of life, at his death, when I saw people celebrating who were on my side of it, I thought, oh my God, that's gross. Like, it gets you that,
you know? Ew, brother.
Yeah.
Oh my God, ew, J-Man.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Most appropriate use of that sound ever, by the way.
So, I have to wonder, like, we'll go a little bit further into this, but where you're going to take it if your first salvo in your defense of the comparison here is that it's okay to celebrate the death of a bad person, right? If that's the place we're going. Well, Jordan Neely, I don't see anyone on the right celebrating that death. They're saying, no, he... What we're saying, what's mostly been said, is that Daniel Penny, the guy on the train that, you know, restrained him, and then part of that restraint was a neck hold, called a it's got a weird name, but a rear naked choke. What that expresses is that there's no limbs between you and the other person. That's why it's naked, right?
RNC, mm-hmm.
Yeah, or an RNC for the UFC fighters, RNC. Because it's extra awkward when you got two dudes without shirts on doing it. You take out the naked word. It's just, it's a homophobia thing.
RNC, no homo.
Exactly. So
gay!
I don't see anyone criticizing that I don't see anyone getting caught out, especially like major media figures saying, you know, celebrating his death.
Right.
Right.
Well, and I don't think that, you know, Daniel Penny wanted to do what he did. He didn't get on that train wanting to harm somebody, mm-hmm. unlike Jordan Neely, who was overtly threatening people, mm-hmm. of all races, by the way, not just you know, white people or whatever, as the sort of, you know, race card is being thrown around in this. This guy was just headed back from school, mm-hmm. right? And was just trying to look out for the other people who are being threatened on this train.
Exactly. So so that in the best light that you can put that, I don't see anyone doing that. Now, Kyle Rittenhouse, you have a guy who's literally acting in self-defense, and people are still trying to rework that into, this is white supremacy, as he kills two white guys, or a white guy, and shoots another. That, you know, those sorts of dynamics are existing to hypnotize a group of the public. I think that's the right word. That's like Adam's word. I think it works into creating a narrative where I don't think there's a sound narrative, right? There's not a clear set of facts that you're basing your opinion on at that point. That's going to lead you astray, take you into weird places where all of a sudden now you're saying, well, it is really, you know, I'm not going to differentiate between these kinds of applications of use of force. So, yeah, that's my thought right to start with.
Of course, there is this sort of, you know, I think we have to separate this analysis of this person as a private person, as a father or husband or whatever, like I said, that's for their family, and what they represent politically. Why are we talking about this person? How do we know this person? Why is their murder getting so much attention and other people's aren't? And in that realm, as a kind of public figure representing certain ideas or certain ways of doing things or certain practices, of course, we're allowed to express happiness or sadness or some other emotion that's different than what we would express if we were visiting the family as part of the wake.
Yeah, I mean, of course.
And look, real quick?
I really appreciate your point about First Prince.
Is he really just suggesting, like, we can be, we can feel one way and then just be disingenuous when we're talking to their faces?
A little bit, maybe. Yeah. I mean, I can see you can separate. What he's trying to do is create a justification to separating these two things of what they mean in the public discourse. And obviously, that's a different level of analysis than them as an individual. But if you lose their individuality in your public discourse, you've lost something important, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, you're justifying the murder of a father, you know, a guy who came from humble means and you know, rose through the corporate ranks, as you were talking about before we started recording, because he's a symbol of something that the left doesn't like, which is the healthcare system in this country and CEOs specifically as like this, you know, archetypal villain.
Right. And you really need to note here, as we listen through this, I mean, listen for the loss of humanity for this person as you aggregate him into a group, into a symbol that you don't like, but keeping in mind that the symbol in this case is a real human being.
Right.
Right. Just as both these people would not appreciate that symbolism being applied. Don't do it. Being applied to Palestinians associated with terrorism and Hamas.
Right.
Of course, because everyday Palestinians who happen to be war fighters of a certain age, right? It's easy when it's babies, right? We can just be like, well, those are babies. But that's not only people that they're going to object to being killed in Palestine.
Sure.
It's also going to be the male-aged fighters who maybe aren't fighters, that they're just plumbers and electricians and regular people.
I'm just noticing that what you identified there with the left compassion of the loss of life in Palestine is for groups. It's for Palestinians. It's for fighters. It's not for individuals necessarily. Is there something at play here where the left tends to apply empathy to groups collectively more so than individuals just by their core philosophy.
Well, I think it could be that. I wouldn't say that's necessarily unique to leftism, right? That's just a collectivist error that we commonly make. If our social norms were overwhelmingly individualistic in its orientation, right? We apply justice individually, it's harder to arrive at these conclusions. You can still do group analysis, but it constrains your group analysis, especially in questions of justice, because, and this is one of the mental models we brought up before, but we're going to be talking a lot about today, which is just this idea of methodological individualism. So in economics, methodological individualism says that what you want to try to measure are the things that you can, that of individuals making decisions versus aggregate data, right? Aggregate data can lead you astray because you don't understand the underlying mechanics of that data or why it exists. You just take that as your first axiom. That first axiom isn't reliable, unlike individual decision-making where you can say, this individual chose Crest over Tide or whatever. Does that make sense?
I mean, Colgate would be a better example because Tide is a laundry detergent.
Whatever. But you and I.
They were eating Tide Pods.
This is fair. And they may very well clean your teeth. I don't actually know.
And but they get rid of COVID. Do they really? Just kidding. That was bleach.
You're going to get us canceled for false health information. Thanks, brother.
Get your information at COVID19.org.
Well, let's keep going here.
Principles, but I had two thoughts about that. One is that sometimes I think it's a little overstated. I think that sometimes your principle can be it's good when good things like bad things happen to bad people, and it's bad when bad things happen to good people, and to just acknowledge that it's subjective and you're coming from an ideological place and that you don't have some overarching theory like pacifism or being opposed to the death penalty or whatever, and that there's a time and a place for certain kind of things to advance your own ideological project and just own it and be like, yeah, I'm going to be for my ideological team and not for yours. I think that's fine. Just admit it. But the hand-wringing that says...
But that's the key, right? The admitted part. If you're going to adopt that view, which I think is completely valid, it's not a principle. It's just I'm happy when bad people die who do bad things to people, and I'm unhappy and sad when good people die. Then don't go around when other people are celebrating someone's death and say, how dare you celebrate the death of a person, right? Then just say, no, that person's death doesn't deserve to be celebrated because they're actually a good person. But don't pretend you object on principle.
So, okay, what is the role of first principles? Why do we have principles?
What are first principles?
First principles are your starting point for things. Like what is justice? What is the good? What is bad? What does it mean to be a bad person? How do we define and categorize bad persons so that when you have that, then you can talk about justice? Now, the architecture of justice she's referring to here is the vision of justice of just desserts, right? You reap what you sow. Karma.
Karma, right.
To put it in a leftist way, I guess.
To put it in those woo-woo terms.
But yeah, nothing wrong with that. So the karma vision of justice is that there's something about merit, about if you do good things, you should reap good rewards as an individual. Now, what's interesting here is that she's actually taking the collective identity, she's placing above the individual. She said, because this person represents something I don't like, it's worth it for me to violate my principles, my first principles, to say it's okay, it's a good thing this happened to him.
Ugh,
right? Or it's symbolically important. Or, you know, this mealy, like, halfway language that dehumanizes a human being because you don't like what he represents.
I mean, and she's really just advocating for killing people in cold blood in the streets if you don't like them, is really the essence of what she's saying.
And noting
and
that...
And Glenn Greenwald agreed with her on that.
Yeah.
That's wild to me. Because he's so principled on so many issues, and for him to go this direction on this one is, like, kind of mind-boggling.
Yeah, well, it's going to reveal over the next little stop and play that we're going to do here more about where this is coming from, but it should be noted that this isn't isolated to these two guys, right? It is...
People. Can't say guys anymore.
I meant that the proper way, you know, and like the...
the royal guys?
Hey, guys.
I know words. I have the best words.
But, you know, there's posters of other CEOs being placed around New York City in order to create a climate of fear, not because any of these individuals have cases that deserve death, but because people don't like wealth inequality. The fact that we're not equalitarian, even no matter how impossible pipe dream that is, just to create a climate of fear to, like, you guys, there's something suspicious because you have more money than I think you should have. Never mind the fact that in this case, what we're talking about is a privileged Ivy Leaguer killing a guy from Iowa who grew up with a mother who's a beautician, a dad who's a grain elevator operator. I bet neither of these two people even know what that job is.
You're probably right.
I don't.
He rests his case.
It means you load grain into trucks and into trains. That's what it is. Yep. So that is not exactly owning several golf courses level of wealth.
Totally. And from what I've seen of Luigi Mangione's background as well, just in the last week that he's been kind of all over the news and these internet sleuths have been just digging up everything. His family owned a bunch of nursing homes, like 9 or 10 of them around the Northeast, I believe in Maryland, and a couple of country clubs. But their nursing homes tended to have very, very poor ratings, like not quality living arrangements for elderly people. So like
they weren't the Cuomo ones, right?
No, I don't know that there's any connection there. I don't think they had any in New York.
This is
during
Baltimore,
COVID,
not there.
I don't know. Things are very close up there, so I don't know how attached they are. But nevertheless, you know, this guy, you're exactly right, comes from a family, like a very, very wealthy family.
Yes. So, I mean, and this whole narrative, you know, if you're saying it's good when bad things happen to bad people, you have to define bad. That's actually your first principle. And she has yet, and she never does in this podcast, define why Brian Thompson was a bad person. We'll dig into that next step.
Exactly. The other thought I had is that for as much flack, and you might disagree with me here, I'm interested to hear your thoughts, as much flack as the kind of like power analysis that the left has been making for years has gotten in recent years with all of the scrutiny about kind of, you know, DEI and woke and all of that. To me, there is something consistent about saying, well, you know, at the end of the day, Jordan Neely is a mentally ill person who's frequently unhoused, who had committed some acts of violence and menacing on the subway, but who never killed anybody. And that's something that you can't say about both Daniel Penny and, you know, Brian, very, very, very arguably, I would argue Brian Thompson, if not directly by pulling a trigger, but by being the head of a company who has a 32% denial rate that directly results in the death of so many thousands of Americans each year. And that there's, I think it makes me skeptical of some of the kind of conservative leaning attempts to
stop there for real quick. So Jordan Neely never killed anyone, although he threatened to. But Brian Thompson did kill people because his company that he was CEO of didn't provide services that she thinks they should have in an aggregate sense. Now, I want to note the denial rate thing here, because this was actually also reported by Joe Rogan, another guy I like, who's, I think, wrong about this, who said, oh, well, this is kind of this, you know, this company's bad, and so this is why it kind of speculated on the motive of the shooter is, I think, where this started from. Why do this? Why have the things written on the shell casings? Deny, delay, depose. Think of what it was, referencing a book about health insurance.
Yeah.
The denial rate they're talking about is a complaint from the hospital association about the rate of denial that was happening on a very specific plan. That's not their overall denial rate. That's for Medicaid Advantage.
What is that?
Medicaid Advantage was passed under the Bush administration. It's a piece of legislation that subsidizes insurance for older people. So this is the part where you got to talk about economics, in which case leftists go and they just fall asleep. They just don't care. They don't, those realities that they're just uninterested in. I mean, they'll give you an hour long lecture about the nature of the history of the Middle East in order to explain to you the facts of justice when it comes to Palestine. Brianna's great at that. But when it comes to actual things happening right here in our own country, we'll take zero responsibility for progressives ruining our healthcare system for 100 years. Her ideology, leftist progressive statism, is the reason why healthcare prices are as high as they are today.
Why?
There's so much there. But yeah, exactly. We'll dive into it. All right. So a couple things. If you subsidize suppliers, it does not increase, or it does not decrease consumption. It increases consumption, right? So if you give suppliers, the people who make healthcare, more money, that doesn't decrease consumption, right? That will not decrease prices. In fact, it has exactly the opposite. So
can you go back and explain that again? I just want to make sure that everybody's tracking that.
So, and I'll tell the history here and I'll make it clear too. College, you give out a Pell Grant, tuition prices don't go down. They go up.
So you put money into the healthcare system or the education system, prices don't come down because there's more money in the system. They actually go up.
So Medicaid Advantage is a specific government program with constraints where you can only do so much, right? But it is subsidized by the government. That doesn't make all of healthcare cheaper. It increases the price.
Right, because you're not increasing the supply of healthcare per se. You're not bringing more doctors into the system.
Yes.
You're just putting more money into it.
Right. When you do so, you are creating a perverse incentive for them to care less about cost, number one. Number two, when they do have to care about cost, say when there's an increase in demand at the same time that you're doing this, you result in needing to arbitrage your existing capital.
Okay, explain that like we're five.
Arbitrage existing capital, meaning I have to decide trade-offs in my existing capital because United Health also pays Medicaid Advantage. Does that make sense? They are subsidized by the government, but they only have so much money in Medicaid Advantage in that situation, right? They don't have... There's this like this illusion that healthcare insurance companies have an endless amount of resources. Right. Scarcity is not eliminated when you subsidize something, right? You just increase the price of things.
Right. So just because the government gave United Healthcare a bunch of money and all insurers a bunch of money to cover Medicare Advantage doesn't mean that there's going to be more doctors to serve more people if there's increased demand.
Yes.
Which there is continually increased demand because boomers are getting older and there's constantly more and more people needing healthcare.
Specifically in this program that
yes,
we're talking about.
Yes.
I mean, a lot of boomers are literally the peak of the boomer curve is happening now. So there's a huge crunch on medical.
So they have to go about and say, okay, we only have so many resources. We only get so much money from Medicare Advantage. We have to decide who gets care and who doesn't.
Mm-hmm. And we only have so much of other premium payers coming into that system. So, and not to mention, the things that are covered and uncovered are sometimes a private decision of United Health, but oftentimes are actually determined by Medicare or Medicaid. And I have a personal story about that. So I go to a PT, right?
Physical therapist.
Very regularly. At least I used to when I had a full-time job and all that kind of stuff. When I was doing that, it was covered. I had a thing called dry needling, which was really great for my back. It really, when I'm getting into shape and working out, my back would get tightened up. It was a really great way to release and work on flexibility, mobility. I don't really need it as much now because of that. But towards the end of my work with that PT, it went from being covered to not being covered. Not because my insurance company changed anything, but because Medicaid did.
Hmm.
And Medicaid decided that dry needling was not covered. So it removed it from my private insurance company.
So it was the government that deprived you of healthcare services.
Yes. Yes,
wow.
By a decision for Medicaid, because they just match whatever the government says. The government says this is a practice now. That's what the private insurance do. That exists because of progressives. Another one. Eisenhower is why we have private insurance the way we do, where your employer pays it. He decided that we're going to give a discount in the tax write-off for employer-covered health insurance that's different from individual. Why?
Why? No one knows.
The effect is that it eliminated all the private market, all the individual market, because there's no healthcare, there's no tax advantage to it. That's the government picking, right? That's the government subsidizing a supplier, in this case, of insurance providers that are specializing in partnering with company care.
So because it's subsidized, there's a tax benefit to covering insurance that's paid by an employer. Mm-hmm. The companies that would have maybe otherwise insured individuals directly flocked to get those tax breaks, leaving the people who would pay for their insurance independently, like self-employed people like myself and yourselves, kind of out in the wind.
Right. And that's not even talking about the biggest constraint here. The biggest, and you mentioned it before, more doctors, more hospitals, more medical equipment, all that kind of stuff. And that is the cartelization of the medical industry that was caused by the progressives. You got to go further back. But this is the progenitors of all these ideas, right? So remember, the progressive movement is this idea that we can rationally plan society to eliminate injustice, right? By putting the smartest people in charge. So you look out in the turn of the century of the progressive era, and you have this phenomena where people said, well, there's people who are doing healthcare that I think is not effective. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to put a new board, a union, in charge of what counts as healthcare. And then they're going to be able to rationally plan healthcare so people get better healthcare outcomes. So I'm going to, and what that means economically is I'm going to give a labor monopoly to the American Medical Association forever. So you can't compete with them. You want to start your own medical association? Too bad. Government says there's only one.
What, go f- yourself.
Yeah.
what effect does that have? Saying the AMA is the kind of top
it
dog.
It killed off half the medical schools in the United States. Because they didn't qualify under the American Medical Association.
Why?
At the time.
Why was that?
Because only one kind of medicine counts. Right. So your naturopath, the reason why your naturopath wasn't covered in insurance until very recently, American Medical Association said naturopath does not count. Right. Those are other ones. There's orthodontry or not. No, that's not right. There's a bunch of other approaches to medicine other than the standard American Medical Association practice. Now, some of those were snake oils, right? They're, you know, lick a frog and you'll heal your kidney stones or whatever, right? That existed.
Hey, but
that existed not because, that didn't go away because we had the American Medical Association get put in as a cartel, right? That went away because we had an increased amount of scientific literacy and information flow because of the increased bandwidth of medical research, increased bandwidth to information using television, radio, the internet eventually. All of those things are why we get better healthcare outcomes in a competitive environment. Now, what we've seen is this huge crunch that happened throughout the progressive era and throughout the 20th century that is only now, just barely, just the tiniest bit getting opened up. And the other supply of that is the supply constraints, right? So American Medical Association, the other one's con laws, certificate of need laws. They literally, in the 1970s, put in a law that said, hey, you know what? And you wonder why there are hospital cartels everywhere. Bennett, get this. It's going to blow your mind. We don't like dog-eat-dog competition, right? That's bad. You can't tell me why, but it's bad, right? It's just destructive. It's so hostile. We don't need that. We can better centrally plan healthcare. So what they did is they said, in order to start a new medical product of any kind, you want an MRI machine in Bozeman? You don't get one. You have to ask the government permission first.
Really?
You want to start a new, inpatient medical facility for something because you're a doctor and you just moved to Chicago or whatever? You have to ask the board of the people who are made up of the people you're trying to compete against permission to start your new business.
Wow.
That's what a certificate of need law was. It dominated medical industry from the 1960s and 70s all the way right up until the last decade when slowly Republicans have been repealing it at the state level. That was a progressive policy.
That's insane.
Yeah. The leftists are one of the ones who gave us that because they don't like dog-eat-dog competition. And this all has to do with this emotional argument to say, well, we don't want that point in your life when you're sick where you have to shop. You shouldn't have to shop, right? You should just get the care that you want. And I can understand that. I've been in a medical emergency before with someone I loved, and it's very difficult to make rational decisions at that point. But the cost of that, when you eliminate competition and create cartels and monopolies, is higher costs. So then we get the problem that they're talking about now.
And worse care, less variety of the care you might want to get.
Yeah, and we get this monolithic, singular thing that is medicine that now all the progressives and leftists are saying, this is what's the problem. They create the FDA, and then they're like, well, what the FDA is doing all these things we don't like. It's like, well, stop creating the thing. Stop creating the monopoly. But they don't ever learn anything because they don't look at the economics. They don't care about the economics. Even when you tell it like a history story, right? And I say, Eisenhower did this thing, it has this perverse consequence. Or they did this thing called con laws, and now it has this perverse consequence. It's just like, well, yeah, but if we just did it right, or we just spent more money in it, if we just had more resources. Medicare and Medicaid is some of the largest budget items in the government. When people say, we spend more, you've heard this before, we spend more money and get worse healthcare outcomes. It makes this association as if these were just two measurements that are completely relevant to each other. But it's a corollary measurement. It's not the same thing. All countries that are wealthier spend more money on healthcare.
Yeah.
You know why? Because you ever made more money than you made last year? Sometimes you spend it on healthcare, right? That's what that means. That doesn't mean anything. It doesn't. It doesn't say that there isn't value in other things that you can do in healthcare and healthcare reform and stuff like that. You know, fine. You want to do the we're going to put labels on seed oils. Okay, fine. Empower people with knowledge and information. But when you create the monopolies, you don't get to complain when the monopolies don't serve the thing that you want to do. And you say, well, if we had just done universal healthcare in the beginning, everything would have been better. Because that's false. That has trade-offs too, because guess what? When you monopolize something, just like we do with healthcare insurance companies, like what the Affordable Care Act did, which killed off all of United Healthcare's competition, all the smaller competition, all the competition that would have been there said, no, we would have covered that. You should go spend your money with us. When Obamacare killed that off, these people supported it because it was a step on the way to single payer. This is what they want. They created this system. And it's fucking insane because no one cares about the history. No one cares about everything they've been doing for 100 years to create this situation.
They only care about what did you call it earlier? The tyranny of the moment?
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Which is now that we're here, what do we do? Right. Now it doesn't matter. Okay. Well, you can't change the American Medical Association. You can't do blah, 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 blah. So just like Russia-Ukraine, right? You could tell the story of Russia-Ukraine that starts with NATO expansion. And then winds yourself up at provoking Russia, right? Scott Horton does that in his new book. You should check it out. If you tell that story about health insurance, maybe they go like, well, whatever. It doesn't matter now. I mean, those all exist for good reasons. There's just this institutional bias that says the experts in charge who failed us through COVID are somehow going to get it right now. When, of course, they're not.
No, and they never have. Because how can they? How can a small group of people effectively plan an entire economy for a diverse country of 350 million people.
Right. And what that turns you into, and the progressive vision turns you into a pawn. It turns you into this little character, this little actor that the government has to mother in order to get the best outcome, rather than treating you like an adult who's capable of making his own decisions and capable of shopping for healthcare. I mean, they established the insurance system, which was supposed to be for disaster care, for more and more things. Insurance now covers your yearly physical, the most predictable expense possible, right? Progressives tried to stop the advancement of healthcare savings accounts.
What is healthcare savings account and why would they want to stop it?
Okay, healthcare savings accounts it's the solution to so much of these problems. And these are the guys who fought it. Why? Because it's more free market, right? It puts you more in the driver's seat. And it's because, you know, middle class people and wealthier people are the people who are going to benefit the most from it, which is that from their point of view is just inherently unjust. Fine. Leave that aside for a minute. But just think about it for a second. If you're saying what one of our problems is that people don't have the savings in order to pay for any of the deductibles on these healthcare expenses, for the small things or the things that built up or non-disaster care. How can we incentivize people to do that themselves to the greatest degree possible? What healthcare savings account is just a special savings account that allows you to create a tax deduction out of your contributions to it. So you put $2,000 into your healthcare savings account that reduces your taxable liability for that year, your total income liability calculation by $2,000, right? So that income calculation actually benefits lower income people more than upper income people do, right? If you make $150,000 a year, the $3,000 or $5,000 you put in your healthcare savings account doesn't matter for shit when it comes to which tax bracket you're in, right?
Yeah.
But it does matter if you're at $60,000 a year. It matters a lot, right? Because that could bump you down to 58, and once you're then you're in a new tax bracket. Does that make sense?
Yep.
So that process itself benefits the working class some of the most. And it's a really great incentive structure for you to save for yourself, because the problem with insurance, because it is insurance itself is a bit of a progressive vision. We're all going to pull all of our money together into a big pot. And then when you have an expense, the pot covers you, right? Healthcare sharing ministries do that just fine. These guys probably would oppose, frankly, Democrats and leftist Democrats are the biggest opponents to allowing healthcare sharing ministries and folks like that.
Is that from competing in the insurance market? A religious sort of like pool?
Yeah, or? Because what it does is it says like it rather than arbitrage on the expense side, it arbitrages on the income and the incoming side. Right? I'll
explain that like I'm five.
So arbitrage is whenever I use the word arbitrage, and it's just the best word for it. Maybe I can find a better one. Correct me if I'm going off here somewhere, but arbitrage is where you're separating the most needful from the most want, right? So your most needful, right, is upfront, and given that scarcity exists, which is one of the economic principles leftists refuse to learn, you have to prioritize what you're going to spend money on, right?
Yeah, yep.
So given that there's not an infinite amount of capital, you can arbitrage, meaning you decide to do some things and not other things, right? On the payout side or on the incoming side. So healthcare sharing ministries and other healthcare sharing services arbitrage on the incoming side. So it says, do you smoke? Oh, I'm sorry, you can't be part of our group.
Mm.
That's that they don't like, right? They say, well,
it's denial of care.
Yeah.
Potentially.
Right. By on the incoming side.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not saying these two individuals do, but this is something that leftists and progressives have. So if we're going to deal in collective guilt here, you're going to take your bit of collective guilt. And your collective guilt for the progressives is establishing all of this stuff and making a thing and keeping all the actual answers happening. Sharing ministries and stuff like that have existed for a very long time, but they've been pushed to the fringes because they don't qualify for employee, you know, contribution and all that kind of stuff until very recently, when finally from the state level, some Republican legislators around the country have been making gains in these areas and deregulating healthcare. But they act in this insane way that ignores all the history and just says, well, we have a free market in healthcare and it's failing us.
So this is what they think a free market is.
Yeah.
Great.
All right. So we got a little bit, two more minutes because Glenn's going to come back in here. And I think this is where we haven't even started yet.
David's just lighting the fuse now.
Undermine the idea
that
power
ready.
Analysis is really critical to understanding the moral stakes of these kinds of controversies.
Yeah. I think we have to talk about the specifics of it rather than these concepts that are running around it, because otherwise we risk losing the analysis that's actually connected to those two incidents if you're trying to compare these two. So first of all, just legally, there's an obvious difference, which is that what Brian Johnson was doing as the CEO of United Health, as despicable and immoral as it was, is legally sanctioned. It's not illegal. It's not a crime to do that. We've made it legal for health insurance companies to be privatized and to bilk people and exploit them at their worst time of need purely for profit, even if it means destroying them at their time of greatest vulnerability. Whereas going onto a subway and menacing people and basically saying, I'm about to do things I'm going to go to jail for life, putting people in real fear, imminent fear of their body because they're trapped in a subway with a person who clearly seems to be unhinged. That's not legal. If they had just detained him and not killed him, he could have easily have been arrested and gone to prison. So I do think there's that difference. But on moral grounds, I think that you can make the case that what the CEO of United Health is doing is more harmful, more fatal, more deadly, and therefore more deserving of a violent response to stop it than what was done on the subway by the homeless person who got on and started menacing people.
Okay. So that's the methodological individualism, right? It's what he represents. So, and also noting that insurance companies haven't been privatized, right? They've always been private, with an increasing some of the most government regulations in our society, period. Insurance companies are subject to some of the most, you know, egregious, like get all into your business practices, regulations, regulatory environments, boards, certifications, all across the board, right? All in the progressive dream of if you regulate it enough, it will become better. While they constrain supply, while they subsidize supply, while they subsidize demand, as you spend money on Medicaid, as you shut down people's ability to compete with each other, as you then also, you know, create a condition where people have to have more medical insurance in order to pay for things because you're increasing the price by increasing all the money in that system without increasing productivity.
Right. And how, I mean, just speaking to the productivity side, like this is something that I think often gets overlooked by the left. How is it moral to require a doctor to serve you and not get paid? Right? How is it moral to be able to mandate that someone give care that they're not paid for?
Right. That's the healthcare is a right thing. Now, healthcare prices are high and higher than they otherwise would be because of the progressive era, because of they owned the 20th century and created this system. This wasn't free markets. This wasn't Reaganism, right? It didn't change anything about healthcare. It really wasn't until the 2010s where Republicans actually and the conservatives actually started to go on the fence on some of these things, on the smallest things. And we couldn't even repeal Obamacare. So, you know, and then additionally to that, there's just like the moral philosophical argument that there's an equivalency between what Brian Thompson represents as a symbol of what you obviously don't like because you're calling privatization, as if there is a natural way of life that healthcare shouldn't be a product, right? That it isn't it shouldn't be subject to the reality that scarcity exists,
right?
Right, and this pretending that scarcity, that if you just eliminated CEO pay, right? If you just said no CEOs can make more than this amount, that there wouldn't be unintended negative consequences to that. This belief that prices themselves are arbitrary and don't represent a signal to anything, are meaningless, is a doctrinal, foundational, theological thing for these guys. And so they can't conceptualize that actually what we're talking about is billions of dollars in existing capital with billions of more potential demand out there that you could pay for if at any given time people requested services. So you have to do a calculation of what you're going to cover and what you're not. I'm not defending United Healthcare's any individual decision. What I'm saying is that you've subsidized them. You've regulated the hell out of them. You've constrained the supply of everybody that they sell to, right? The doctors and hospitals and stuff like that, their customers. You've given them a cartel, and then you're complaining about it, right? And that's insane. That's really frustrating, right?
Yeah.
So and then you're saying that this guy's guilty of murder for the reality that scarcity exists, which is completely different moral situation than I go onto a train and I threaten women and children.
Completely. I don't know how you created an equivalency between these two events, personally. That's just insane to me.
but he does it with a completely straight face. And that's the shame of it, right? Because moral thinking here, I mean, equivalent to where these guys are good on issues of compassion for, you know, people in this situation, right? So I get that, you know, the leftists are saying, hey, we have this thing that we don't know what to do with the homeless population, right? We don't want to involuntarily commit them, right? Because there's been crimes in the past of that, right? Where husbands don't like their wives, and so to get out of divorce, they commit their wives to a mental institution, right? That's obviously not where we're at now. We've probably, if you read Sicko and the work of Michael Schellenberger on homelessness in California, what he articulates is that there's been a swing so far to the left that is so worried about compassion for this community, you're actually making it worse for that community. That some people actually need to be committed,
yeah,
before they can do harm to themselves and others because they're not like fully in control of themselves.
Well, they're almost some of them are completely out of control of themselves, and just enabling them by giving them access to clean needles or a place to do drugs or whatever it might be is just exacerbating the problem.
Yeah, and Jordan Neely fulfills that category very clearly. Yeah. He was a known figure who had a violent past. He was known as someone who's suffering from schizophrenia, who was, you know, like actually had violent interactions with people in the past. Did the system fail him? Yeah, they failed him by not incarcerating him. The very thing that Brianna would oppose to. Right, because if we're in this fantasy world where scarcity doesn't exist, that we're just going to enter into because we've collectivized everything, all of a sudden now we're going to have the resources to provide him a house, and he's just going to treat that house as if it was private property, because that's what Brianna would do, but that's not what this person would do, because we know this, because we were experimenting with this. We've been doing housing first for 3 decades now.
Housing first is when someone is given a home and then expected to comply with, you know, staying clean and things like that.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and kind of. Some of these situations, they don't have to stay clean, right? They just, yeah.
As opposed to proving that you deserve it or want it, you know, by getting clean first.
Yes.
And then you get a thing.
Yeah.
Right. So it's just like flipping the incentive structure completely on its head.
Right. So this whole argument that it leaves aside an actual question of our own standard of justice, of just desserts. Does Jordan Neely deserve you to buy him a house? Answer that question for me. What has he done to deserve that? And I'm sure her answer is like, well, he's a member of society. And he himself should be dealt with compassion. Okay, how much of my money does he get? Well, it's not your money. It's the wealthy people's money. It's Brian Thompson's money. Brian Thompson, the guy who actually worked his entire life and held down a job, even though it probably would have been easier to do something else.
He's got to pay.
Yeah, he has to pay. And he didn't pay. So therefore, he deserves to die, right?
Yeah.
I mean, because what he symbolically represents to these people,
yeah.
which shows you it has less to do with actually providing resources or real common sense care to the homeless people and more to do with hating the rich. Right. And that's the road to Wigan Pier. And that's not me saying this. This is George Orwell, one of the most famous socialists of the last century, saying, hey, guys, you know, when looking at this question of the British working class, all the people who actually advocate for this don't actually like these people. They don't want to deal with them. They avoid them at all costs. They don't pay the price. They're not on the train with Jordan Neely. They're taking an Uber. Right? They don't. All the people in Brianna's situation and Glenn's situation here, they don't have to deal with that because they're wealthy liberal intellectuals. They just don't like other wealthy liberal intellectuals. Right? It's not that they actually like the poor. Now, that's a little bit harsh in this given circumstance, but the amount of animosity for Brian Thompson for what he represents, because you believe it should be a government-controlled healthcare system, kind of signals that underlying bias to me.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
One thing about this too, the effort here by the guy under trial, I just spaced his name, Daniel Penny, was to restrain him until cops can come. But you're on a train. And this is a schizophrenic person who is also probably consuming drugs. So in the trial, for example, there's two medical experts, one brought in the prosecution, one by the defense. And then a jury of his peers said, well, the defense has the better case here. So these guys, you know, would normally say like, well, the court process has had its day, right? And this guy's innocent because of the court process. Well, no. Actually, we got to question that for some reason. I'm not sure what it is, but we got to hold that back because detaining was obviously what the jury found he was doing, not trying to commit murder. In fact, they tried to charge him with intentional murder and then they couldn't. So then they came with a lesser charge and then they couldn't even do that.
Wow.
Right. So with this whole case, I mean, and one of the things I think that happens here in a lot of these police stuff, and I'm not a police officer, but I am a security guard, and I've practiced jiu-jitsu for 6 years. Over that time, in that practice, I know a little bit about choking people and restraining somebody. And with that, there's a lot of armchair quarterbacking that seems to me to be so based in ignorance. It has no clue what's going on. They don't know how a chokehold works. They don't know what kills you in a chokehold.
Why don't we explain that really quick? What are the mechanics of the situation?
Do you want me to show you?
No.
Yeah, let's do
absolutely
it.
Not.
You can do it to me.
Okay, sure.
Okay. Okay, so basically how it works is your neck is constrained of three different sectors, right? You have carotid artery, and your windpipe, right? So a good rear naked choke places your elbow at the center of my windpipe and then squeezes here
to then create a compression
that does that, right? So if you squeeze here, that's what causes unconsciousness, right? Constraining the blood flow here, cuts off circulation in the brain, and you fall asleep.
Like very quickly.
Yeah, it can happen typically. Quite quickly, depending on how good the connection is.
Sure.
Now, what typically happens is if your elbow is forward enough, it creates that compression on the side. If it's not forward enough, it creates a compression on your windpipe. Mm. That's what can kill you. Now, compression here can put you to sleep, and only in some rare circumstances, if say, for example, like this guy had, drug use problems and a blood disease, a blood condition, a relatively rare blood condition, can mean that when your carotid, when the arteries close, they don't open back up again.
Mm. He was probably denied care for that though.
Well, one of the reasons why he was denied care was when the paramedic showed up, they refused to actually provide some services to the guy to resuscitate him, even though his pulse was still going, because they were worried about contracting HIV.
Oh. Oh.
When the police showed up. Sorry, no, I didn't
say you have AIDS.
Yes.
I'm sorry.
It's a joke, guys. It's a humor. It's okay.
I couldn't help it. It's like a tick.
We're not celebrating his death. We're just joking. It's the difference between jokes and celebration. So anyways, like that's the thing that that's the thing that bothers me there. And so Daniel Perez, watching the video, he has relatively loose hold on his neck. I suspect that it was probably a confluence of events that resulted in his death, that was probably unintentional, that resulted from at first, the aggressor in this situation, this is the non-aggression principle, this is what libertarians operate on, and it's actually a very insightful moral theory on the questions of justice of good people and bad people, Brianna, is this idea, the person who initiates force or threatens the initiation of force against innocent people who are just minding their own business and riding on a train, that's the bad guy, believe it or not. And the guy that steps in to defend innocent people is the good guy, right? If that results in a in an unintentional death in the restraint of that person, the bad guy, the good guy doesn't become a bad guy. He becomes a victim of that person's assault against innocent individuals who are who he's just trying to prevent from assault happening against innocents.
Yeah.
Noting in this case, Daniel
Penny.
Daniel Penny. Danny Penny.
You just did a Dave Smith. It's fine.
Yeah, it's he himself is a Marine, not a former Marine, is a Marine and a student. He's not some wealthy person. The power dynamic that Brianna is talking about here has nothing to do here. This is completely the opposite. This is one poor person, you know, low-income person, saying to a homeless, you know, a person with psychological issues who has refused care and help from harming other individuals who are low-income and innocent and specifically unable to defend themselves, like yeah. women and children.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and then equivocating that to Daniel, the healthcare CEO, Brian Thompson, say his name.
Well said.
Who was already receiving death threats, right? We already know this. At least that's what his wife says. And this kind of like, this case is, it aggregates in the most disgusting way, saying, well, he is not an individual who's individual guilty because some people die in healthcare services when there's an increase in demand at the same time that he's a person, a CEO. Now, maybe that's not really what it is. Maybe it's all just greed. But lying underneath this is this assumption that the entire system's greed-based rather than scarcity-based. And that bias themselves, you have to contend with. If you just ignore the scarcity problem, you're not doing commentary. You're doing religion. Right, you're not analyzing anything. You're not doing a power dynamic analysis. You are just doing religion. You're saying this entire system is based upon greed, not based upon the reality that we have scarce resources we have to deploy in a situation that you've created where they're a cartel.
Yeah, and you're dealing with sort of trying to assume intentions and motivations of people as opposed to dealing with the actual mechanics of the economy.
Right. So I want to talk about one more thing with this because I'm sure both of these people would say, well, David, well, Joe, if they ever talk to us.
Which they will never do now.
Yeah, yeah. Hopefully they will. But if we just had socialized medicine, these greedy people wouldn't exist, right? You wouldn't have healthcare CEOs with this enormous pay, right? They'd be going and they'd be doing this in other areas of the industry that maybe should be privatized, right? But this one shouldn't be because there's something gross about profit and the profit motive here. Now, don't get me wrong. You can have fraud. Healthcare insurance industries could do fraudulent things. They could violate contracts. They can do all the things that humans do. But guess what? So can governments. Governments can do it, but as you know from the surveillance stuff that the government does all the time, do it with less accountability. Oh, do it without paying any price whatsoever. When there was a competitive environment for healthcare insurance and for medical provision, bad actors could be prosecuted. Now, arguments people say is like, well, you can't sue an insurance company because they just delay. They have all these army of lawyers and you can't sue them. That's not the fault of the healthcare insurance industry. That's a fault of the government. The government is slow in court provision because they have a monopoly in courts, right? You create a monopoly that says there's only one person who can provide legal services. Therefore, you can't get access to them. Therefore, you have to arbitrage them. And the arbitrage metric you can use because they have to provide court service to everybody is time.
Yep.
So they provide all these perverse incentives and then complain about the outcome. Now, if you reverse all those incentives and put it into the government, they have the same ones. For example, Alfie Evans. Do you remember the story from 2018?
Yes.
Young boy in the UK. He was diagnosed with a rare neurodegenerative condition. His parents wanted to go to another country, just take their own child and go to another country and privately for themselves pay for services outside that country. And a court in the UK said, no, because it's not, because the National Health Service's doctors provided that it wasn't in his best interest.
Living?
Living.
A chance at life. right? It was Democrats, all Democrats, who voted against Montana's, and I know this one the most familiar, but they, I think they're the ones who led on the national level too, if I remember right. Correct me if I'm wrong there. Who objected to right to try because they said it was corporations experimenting on people.
With the people's voluntary consent.
Yes. They lose the moral thread when they say, actually, the expert knows better than you do about what to do about their life. Now, if it comes to drug use and Jordan Neely, they have no problem with that.
Absolutely.
But when it comes to healthcare services, all of a sudden they're in charge. And they get to tell you that. Canada did the same thing. Stephanie Laveau? Yeah. A young woman, she was treated with, she had untreated Lyme disease. The case became widely discussed after she had to go to the United States for a diagnosis. She got to escape a little bit to actually get it diagnosed, not to get it treated for.
Which is it's a very complex disease, and it's actually really hard to even know you have it and to get it diagnosed.
Yeah, it was probably created by the government, too.
Really?
Long story.
That's a future skip.
Repeatedly, she was repeatedly denied nutrition support from Canada, and her health deteriorated to the point where she chose medical assistance and dying.
Nutritional support.
Yes.
What does that mean?
I don't the details of the case, whatever.
She was only allowed to eat the porridge that they serve you at the hospital dining hall.
I'm not exactly sure. Regardless, she got to a very low weight. She couldn't treat her Lyme disease in Canada, which is probably an arbitrage situation, right? Because it's probably expensive. Mm-hmm. And so she was encouraged to. They created a we'll help you commit suicide program, and then she took that out. So that is the conditions of this. And there's so many others. There's Eddie Filippo, Ontario police officer, was diagnosed with rare cancer. Despite initial treatment, his condition worsened, and he was denied life-saving surgery within Canada, provoking him to go to the United States. The case highlighted the issue with cancer care and availability of treatments in Canada. America has the worst healthcare outcomes when it comes to diabetes because of our lifestyle and the fact we put seed oils and everything. But we have some of the best outcomes in cancer care. Why? Because we have relatively more competition in this space. Relatively, not thanks to you, motherfuckers. Thanks to all the free market care that is existing in the United States. The little bit we got means we have more productive capability, means we have more capacity for high cost treatments like cancer care.
I'm sorry, you said something in there that is a non sequitur for me, given their arguments here. You said that in Canada,
yeah,
this person was denied care.
Yes.
Canada has fully socialized medicine.
Yeah.
How can you be denied care in a fully socialized system?
It's too expensive. They have to arbitrage because scarcity exists. Scarcity does not go away when you collect.
Thus dismantling their entire argument.
You're only changing who decides and whether or not it's a competitive system with choice when you collectivize it. So, and the people who are taking the opportunity of a intentional assassination of a guy to say, well, this wouldn't have happened if we had universal healthcare, are literally saying, next time when we get universal healthcare, when they win, you're going to be advocating for killing bureaucrats now?
Ooh.
Or killing, you know, the guy who's in charge of whoever's running Medicaid?
Yeah, the government employee that's making $500,000 a year to administer or to dictate who gets care and who doesn't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they'll be all for a bunch of J6s now?
that's the problem with it, right? Ultimately, and this is the red pill, like the libertarian red pill, is that there's only trade-offs in life. There's no final solutions. There's no ways to do it where there are no trade-offs. You cannot eliminate scarcity by regulating it enough. That's not how it works. The best thing we can do is navigate trade-offs in a competitive environment with freedom of choice, where that maximizes consumer choice and therefore maxes productivity. Because if you increase in wealth, and we have increased in wealth, and we have inflationary pressures and stuff like that. We haven't gotten into why people don't have savings is because of the Fed. Leaving that aside, as you increase in wealth, you increase in productive capacity, then you can satisfy your consumer demand because your money means something, right? But as long as you inflate, as long as you subsidize, as long as you constrain supply, you're going to create these kind of outcomes of arbitrage that are going to have to be made. And even in the ideal situation, complete free market utopia, I will freely admit, you're going to have arbitrage. There's going to be cases that aren't going to be covered for whatever reason, right? The best case is where you can utilize public funding, you can utilize crowdfunding and mechanisms like friendly societies and things like that that do pay out in these ways that these people have actually fought over the last 50, 60 years to keep from actually happening. Because they're so focused on this kind of care, of centralized care.
Yeah. As we wrap up, I just want to bring up a topic that we were just chatting about briefly before we started recording, which is sort of the tendency to look at a figure whom you respect on one issue and translate their authority to another area of perhaps relative less expertise, right? Jordan Peterson is a fair example of this. We think he's a, you know, he has a lot of great ideas philosophically, but when his views came out, you know, particularly since he joined the Daily Wire, his foreign policy views are pretty terrible by our standards. I would say similarly with Glenn Greenwald. I mean, you said it right at the top. We respect him tremendously. He's got a lot of great views on censorship, on foreign policy, but his views on healthcare are completely fucked.
Yeah.
So important to just, I guess, be willing to see an individual at, you know, to give someone credit where credit is due, but to be willing to criticize them in a place where it's deserved.
Yeah, yeah. And everyone should subscribe to his podcast. It's amazing. I forget what it's called right now.
System Update.
System Update, yeah. Daily Update, something like that. And yeah, I mean, I have nothing but respect for the guy. I know I called him a motherfucker just a minute ago. And I'm just saying that.
I thought you were talking about the government, honestly. Yeah. I didn't take that to him.
The audience thought you were talking to them.
Yeah, yeah.
You're full of shit today.
That's for the audience.
But that's the role of freedom of speech in our society, right? The idea is, and I'm not saying he's not qualified to comment on it. I hate that kind of dialogue. I don't like the dialogue that says, oh, you should stick to your lane, that sort of stuff, because that actually, I think, prohibits people from sense-making about things.
Sure.
Right? What we lack in our information environment is a cohesion, right? It's systematized thought that allows you to apply across circumstance in first principle thinking. That's why we talk about mental models. And so we try to cohere around mental models, because hopefully when that new issue comes up to you, when that new thing you haven't considered first impacts you, you're more resistant to hypno narratives, to those kind of like emotional appeals, to those first biases, when you have models to apply to it and think through, as opposed to, you know, I'm just going to kind of have a shelf of ideas that I just on policy, and I'm just going to pull them off the shelf and they're not coherent across their domains. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's the same thing. Like when we talk, we just dropped one on immigration and foreign policy, how those are actually a very combined supply and demand conception of immigration problems. And this is a big problem for the right, and how the right bifurcates those two things and pretends like foreign policy has no impact on immigration. It's the same thing with these. The left has this very narrow centered focus on, you know, I mean, these guys are you know, at least Glenn is very good on COVID response, but doesn't see how it's exactly the FDA and CDC and all these progressive projects that have actually created the bad healthcare environments that we're in right now.
Yeah. On that note, we're going to wrap up for today. We appreciate you for watching.
No, you did such a great job.
Thank you so much.
Dealing with me yelling the
I'm
whole time.
I'm so glad to be here. I take so much joy in just listening to you rant. It's just like, oh, this is just great. I could listen to this all day. Hope you enjoyed it as well. Please do like, subscribe, follow wherever you're getting this content. We appreciate it. And if you would like to join us in the SCIF, where we're going to be headed next, please go to humanreactionpod.com to learn how to get access to that exclusive content. For David Rand and Bennett and our wayward friend Kyle, who is out sick today, we'll see you in the next one.
Thanks for tuning in to Human Reaction. Please be sure to like, follow, subscribe, and give us a review on your podcast platform of choice. And if you want to become a member and support the show financially, check out humanreactionpod.com. And remember,
we should have made jokes about Kyle's healthcare right now.
Canadian healthcare. How did we miss that?
Yeah, what the fuck?
Oh.